Hi, and welcome back to the 9th episode of the Pathfinders podcast. This is the first episode of 2021, and just before we start today's episode, I just wanted to announce that we have actually been nominated for an award at this year's Publishing Podcast Awards. We've been nominated for Best Entertainment Podcast, and we are going up against some big publishers, including Penguin Publishing and their in-house podcast. It was such a shock, but I'm so pleased that we've got the nomination, and I just wanted to thank you all so much for your support, because without you listening to this podcast, then we wouldn't have got this nomination. Today's episode features an interview with Professor Charles Spence, who is a professor of experimental psychology at Oxford University. Charles is a world expert in multisensory perception on the remarkable ways that we use our senses to lead richer lives. His new book called Sense Hacking, How to Use the Power of Your Senses for Happier, Healthy Living, explores various different aspects of how our senses feed into our own lives. What color clothing can make you perform better in sports, why certain plates can make food taste sweeter, and how furniture can affect your well-being. These are just a few questions that Charles's new book covers. In today's interview, we explore Charles's work, as well as deep diving into some of his topics covered in his new book. We conducted this interview whilst Charles is currently situated in Colombia. Before we get into today's issue, if you would like to support the podcast, then the best way to do so is by visiting the 99% Lifestyle store. We have a range of different print magazines, including the latest issue, Volume 6 of 99% Lifestyle. Each edition features tons of interviews and stories with creators from all over the world, such as how UFC fighter Justin Wren used his platform to free a tribe of cannibalized pygmies, to diving deep into the clothing brand P&Co and exploring their history and how they have coped during the pandemic. You can go and find that out or by clicking the links in the description of this episode or visiting 99%lifestyle.com. Now, let's get into today's episode with Professor Charles Spence. So, yeah, just to get things started, I suppose, could you tell people a little bit about yourself and give them a quick introduction to who it is you are and what you do?
My name is Professor Charles Spence. I'm head of the Crossmodal Research Laboratory at Oxford University. I'm a psychologist interested in the senses and how the latest insights from psychological science and brain science about how our senses are so connected can be used in the design of better objects, packages, environments, foods, really sort of fascinated in the use of the senses to improve well-being and performance, productivity, and beyond.
And how is it you got fascinated in all of this?
So I've been studying the senses now for, I guess, a quarter of a century or so. And kind of got into it in a way by chance, just when I was a student. I had to do a project for my psychology degree and didn't know what to do and left it too late. And got sent to somebody who had a broken TV and who had his sound coming out through his hi-fi. And that led to some sort of strange illusions when movies started. And the good old days of VHS, when the sounds of the kind of the introductory credits rolling at the start of the film, just sort of music and everything would seem okay. But as soon as the credits finished rolling and the first person spoke on the screen, there'd be a sudden like disconnect because the voice wasn't coming from the screen, it was coming from the hi-fi. And then a few moments later, people had their brains would kind of glue it all back together again and you wouldn't be aware that anything had been wrong. Because your brain sort of puts the voice together with the lips, like with a ventriloquist's dummy. And my first project was around that, sort of taking televisions and breaking them effectively by moving the sounds around to the right or the wrong place and seeing how people sort of dealt with the mismatch. And that sort of led on then to a lot of work on talking while driving. So again, trying to look one way out of the front of your car while listening to what somebody's saying, maybe out of a handheld device. And other kind of limits on our ability to concentrate on different things at the same time. So a lot on technology allows us to disconnect the senses and put them in all different places and have them related or not, whereas our brains kind of evolved in an environment where we like to kind of focus on one location, on one thing, and extract all the sensory information about it. whereas technology kind of distribute stuff in ways that our brains weren't evolved for. And hence I'm really interested in those sort of limits in our mental capacity to deal with sensory inputs. And from those sort of early days on the design of warning signals then and technology in cars, sort of moved on to the world of paint and fragrance, thinking about how you can, through knowing about how the senses connect, sort of design healthier environments. And then on to a lot of work on the design of food and drink experiences. That was the kind of subject of the last popular science book, Gastrophysics, from 2017. And now kind of in 2021, just came out with Sense Hacking, a new book from Viking Penguin, that in a way is sort of a natural progression from the gastrophysics. On the one hand, my editor told me you can't write about food again, because if you do, you'll get pigeonholed. But at the same time, I think anything you can do to people's experience of like a meal in a restaurant, by changing the music, by changing the lighting, by changing the description, by changing the scent, you can do exactly the same thing to kind of people. If you put people in the place of the plate, then the environments we inhabit, what they look like, what they sound like, what they smell like, all influence us as much as they influence how we perceive food. And hence that provides kind of a nice way in then to think about how to optimize sort of multi-sensory design of the environments we inhabit to try and help us enhance our well-being, our productivity, something that's probably especially important given the current series of COVID lockdowns.
Yeah, and just before I wanted to talk about your new book, I did want to ask a few questions around the previous book and your work on food, because The Guardian described you as the food scientist changing the way that we eat. And I really wanted to know how you became fascinated with that particular area, because you've worked with the likes of Heston Blumenthal and you've done a lot of, you've got a big body of work in that subject.
That's right. So it was kind of an accident. I've always been interested in the senses and applying kind of the science of the senses to real life. But that kind of started off with just technology, with hearing and vision. And then I brought in touch and thinking about, you know, interfaces that vibrate and we touch and that touch us. But I'd never really have got into the world of food and drink because some of my colleagues who are interested in the psychology of the senses study that. It's like, that's what chefs do and food scientists, but not what psychologists do. And it was really kind of by accident that my lab in Oxford, the Crossmodal Research Laboratory, has always been primarily funded by industry. And for the first 13 years or so, that was primarily from Unilever. And we do various projects for them around the design of laundry detergent scents and deodorant sounds. So sort of product development, and then they had a problem with their fruit teas, that sort of, you know, fruit teas that look intensely coloured, that smell great, but when you taste them, they're kind of a bit disappointing. There's not really much flavour to them. And we were brought in to try and help address that question by looking at the colour of food. And in the first place, not because we were interested in it really, but just because they were paying the bills, and so why not try and see what happens? And then it just sort of exploded without really realizing it. We went on to do some work on the sonic chip, on showing how you can make Pringles, but any other crisp in fact, about 15% crisper and crunchier and fresher and more liked simply by boosting the sound that you hear when you bite into such a food. And that research, which we sort of published in some obscure food science journal, got picked up by the Ig Nobel Committee, and got us the Ig Nobel Prize for Nutrition, together with my co-author Max Zampini in 2008. And that got then the interest of the chefs. And it all just kind of, you know, snowballed from there without really realizing it. And so nowadays, I spend a lot of my time kind of going around to my colleagues in different psychology departments, so saying, you know, even if you don't think you're interested in food, you should be, because this is such an important driver of brain development and evolution. And there's so much interesting sort of psychology there. And really, there's probably nothing more multi-sensory, stimulating all of our senses than food and drink. So it's been kind of a an exciting area to get into. Happened by chance and by accident, but in hindsight now I can also see how I think there's a lot more creativity and innovation that goes on, especially with the top chefs and mixologists and baristas, whereas in my early work, applied work, you know, with designing warning signals and technology for car drivers to make driving safer, there are lots of insights we could sort of bring to the table, but the process of innovation is much slower. It takes 10 years or maybe 20 to incorporate your new idea into the next model rolling off the... So that's kind of frustrating in a way, whereas food, if you can convince a chef like Heston Blumenthal of something interesting from the psychology, from the brain science, then they are their own boss, kind of, sometimes, and can then put those ideas into practice. And what the chefs, I think, I've realized have a really great ability to do is sometimes to take the science, which can be dry and sort of boring, and transform it into dishes that make people cry, that they want to Instagram about, that are memorable and delicious. And that's kind of a real skill that you don't so often find, say, in the food industry, and so sort of the chefs working for some of the food companies who can take the science and do something with it, but very often it's nothing you'd really want to eat. Mm-hmm. And the chefs have that sort of magical touch to make the science interesting, delicious, and memorable.
Mm. And when I was doing the research for this interview, I did see that you used an example about how just something as simple as depending on the plate that a certain dish was, a dish used, it could actually make it taste sweeter. And it really got me fascinated with how that actually works. Like how what is the science behind that with the brain?
Yeah. So this is referring to the sort of first study we did on the colour of plates from 2012, we published, and this was done with Ferran Adrià, another world top chef, in his kind of research facility over in Spain. And it's really sort of a natural progression. We started looking at the colour of food for years, and then suddenly thought, well, everything we eat or drink is always comes in a glass or a cup, or it's served on a plate or in a bowl or in a package, and the colour of the background, the bowl, the plate, the cup, may be important too. And so we just did a study over in Spain with the chef and his team, serving people a kind of strawberry mousse, a pinkish red strawberry mousse, to about 65 people. And half of them tasted the mousse first when it was served on a white plate, and then had to rate some other mousse, which happened to be the same one, on a black plate, or vice versa. Some started with a black plate. And kind of amazingly, those who tasted that strawberry mousse from the white plate rated it as tasting about 7% sweeter, 13% more light, and 11% more flavorful than when they tasted exactly the same food from a black plate instead. And at the time, in 2012, it's kind of hard. You can't really taste a plate, so how can the colour of the plate change the taste of the food? It's sort of one of those things that didn't quite make sense, and you weren't really quite sure how robust it was going to be. But 8 years later, 9 years later now, there's probably 40 or 50 published studies from around the world showing that plate colour and material can have an impact. Plate shape too, I should say. And how it is, we still don't know for sure. All the extra evidence says it really does occur, and it might be that the colour of food we see, we never really sort of just see the colour of the food. It's always a matter of how it compares and contrasts to the background. In the same way that, you know, when you go to the store and you try and buy some paint for your living room, and when you get it home on the walls, it's kind of a different colour from the one that was in the catalogue. And that's kind of this sort of colour contrast type effects. So it might be that the pinkish, the colour of the food looks different depending on the background against which it's placed. Or it may be that our brains probably keep a record of all the food we've ever eaten. Not sort of consciously, but we kind of keep track of the statistics of our environment, and food's a part of that. And it may just be across our lifetimes, if something comes on a black, angular, say, shaped plate or a slate, it's probably more likely to be savoury, to be cheese board or something, than sweet ice cream, whereas things that come on round and white receptacles are more likely to be sweet on average, possibly. So as soon as I see the plate, I'm kind of guessing what's going to be on it, and those predictions might influence our behaviour. Or just maybe, third explanation that might also be partly true is that there's something about the colour combinations So we're doing some work, kind of more design work, really, trying to use pairs or triplets of colors to convey a thought, a flavor, a fragrance or something, or maybe this sort of strawberry, sweet strawberry dessert. And there it turns out, probably the sweetest color is pinkish red. But if I combine, if I give you pink in front on white, if I use two colors, you will be more convinced that that's sweet than the sweetest of the individual colors. And hence, maybe it's this pink on white combination that, just as an abstract pair of colors, is really sweet. And hence, it happens to be in food, but if I'm designing a package for you, for a company, for some sweet product, then using pink and white can help, regardless of what the food itself might be therein.
And I find that quite fascinating with the whole, I suppose, colour psychology element of things, and how certain colours can make you feel this way and really influence your mind, I guess. In the fifth edition of our print magazine, we did a feature with the paper company GF Smith, and that was all about a big colour psychology project that they did, and about the world's favourite colour, as made by all this data, and what certain colours were attributed to certain moods and things like that. And this ties quite nicely into your new book, because I did notice one of the questions is that it gives an example on the Penguin website is about how a certain colour can make sports teams play better if depending on the colour of clothing that they're wearing. Can you share a bit more information about that?
Right, so I think colours have a profound effect on us. That can be the colour of food, it can be the colour of the environments in which we live, or it could be the colour of the clothes that we wear. And the sort of data and evidence, all of these have an impact. And in the chapter in the book, Sense Hacking, about I look at how you can sort of hack your senses in order to improve your performance at the gym or in terms of sport, sporting performance and prowess. And there, the sort of interesting research around how in team sports, but also sometimes in individual sports, those who wear red seem to be more successful than teams wearing other colours. Also, teams wearing black, like the All Blacks, well, I think, again, there's some sort of connection there in terms of aggression as well. So the colours we wear are kind of arbitrary. Our local club strip or our favourite football team strip, doesn't really matter what colour, it's just an identifier. And yet, colours do have this sort of more fundamental impact on us. And the idea, and this has been shown both from analysing the kind of taekwondo wrestling bouts from the 2004 Olympics, I think it was. And there, people are kind of arbitrarily given a blue or a red strip, I think. For those opponents who are fairly evenly matched, if you ended up wearing the red strip, then you got a slight competitive advantage. If there's a big difference between, wrestlers, taekwondoers, or boxers, then pure skill wins out, of course. But those matches that are a bit more sort of evenly balanced, then the colour of the strip can make the difference between success and failure. Can make the difference between, whether you knock out your opponent or win on points versus you do not. And the same thing's been also shown to be true in sort of football. And I think that the longest continuous records of results in any sport are from the English Football League, which I guess goes back, I'm not really a football fan myself, but it's 1840 or something, or like 150, 160 years of fully documented records. And there too, again, you see a benefit for the team wearing red. And so that's sort of it. Interesting, because that's one way in which you can hack your senses is simply by changing the colour of the things that you wear. On a funnier side, it turns out that, you might think of this as kind of enclothed cognition, would be one way to say it, that if they wear a doctor's outfit, then they suddenly behave more seriously and professionally than if they wear a baseball cap or something. If you wear a Superman t-shirt, the suggestion is then that you sort of take on some of the characteristics of the clothing and the associations, just this embody cognition from the clothes you wear. Our one example from about 1910 was that the American military got very interested. They thought that soldiers who wear red underpants would be more successful in battle. Don't know quite where the original idea came from, but somebody suggested it to the American military, and then they funded research that they published on this. And it turned out, in fact, that as you might expect, the color of soldiers' underwear has no impact on their fighting performance. And yet, about somebody like Superman, if you think about when he's dressed up to perform, then he always wears red underpants. But in contrast to the military, Superman wears his red outside his clothing so other people can see it. And it is probably that element of, you know, how your opponent's brains are affected by what you wear as much as how your own brain is affected by what you're wearing. And there's kind of these two elements to this enclosed cognition or color psychology effects. And yeah, remarkable in a way that, you know, something so insignificant seemingly as the color of your strip should have a significant impact on the outcome of, especially, you know, of sports men and women who are, you know, professionals, spend their life training to do the best they can, and nevertheless they're still influenced. And that even, you know, it's probably something that there's a nice anecdote about Wayne Rooney, who would always, depending on the team's colours, I think it was Manchester City. Again, I'm not a football fan, but he would always go to the kind of the to check with the coach what colour strip are we wearing for tomorrow's game, and then he describes how he'd always spend the night before a big match imagining himself scoring the goals, and you get very upset if he didn't know which colour strip they were going to wear tomorrow, because he needs to be able to go through these kind of mental imagining, preparing for the game, imagining scoring the goals. And he, for one, certainly believed that he'd do that much better if he could visualise the actual colour he'd be wearing. And probably, you know, his sporting performance speaks for itself.
Mm. And in say, like, team sports, is this psychological research kind of influencing the actual designing process of these kits? Or do they just... Because I suppose looking from the outside, when I see a new kit out, I just see it as they've tried to make something that looks good. I haven't really thought before about, is there any psychological stuff going on behind the scenes into why this looks the way it does?
Not as far as I know as yet specifically on the colour of the strip. In part, I suppose, because those colours tend to be, you know, were decided upon decades or maybe a century or more ago. And so it's not so easy for a team to suddenly decide, okay, we're going to change our strip colour to red because the research shows that that will be at an advantage. So I haven't seen it so much there. I'm seeing a bit more of the interest, specifically at the moment, kind of around, you know, the impact of crowd noise and how that can give a home advantage, and how under COVID, of course, lockdowns, you know, there are no crowds, but then how you can kind of tweak or enhance or present, you know, virtual digital stadium noise in order to enhance the performance of the home side. And that, I guess, in the current climate in particular, is something I'm seeing more interest from the teams in, how they can capitalize on that. And then maybe, I don't know whether it's whether there's sort of a, this kind of the story around the colour of clothing, especially sporting clothing and its effect on performance, has probably been out there now for 15, 16 years since the first big studies published saying, look, wow, there's this really strange thing going on here. So it takes a bit of time for the science to percolate out. And then maybe there's almost a kind of belief in some quarters that can't be trite. It can't be that, you know, we can improve our performance just like that. It can't be that easy in a sense. So there may be a certain skepticism that one has to get over as well. And it's just as more evidence mounts up and more data, and that's part of the aim of the book, really, is to sort of highlight, you know, some of the amazing findings around the power of the senses that are out there now and that have been replicated and kind of extended to try and sort of, you know, motivate people into action.
Mm. And before we look more about what is inside the book, the new book, Sense Hacking, How to Use the Power of Your Senses for Happier, Healthy Living is the title. I just wanted to know a bit about how the book came about and what made you decide to publish something different from the previous book.
So in a sense, Sense Hacking kind of is actually a continuation of what I was thinking about almost 20 years ago now. And kind of before I really got into the world of food and drink, back around 2000, shortly thereafter, I've been commissioned by ICI to write a report around the power of the senses and sort of senses and how, and ICI at the time was seen as a sort of a hardcore chemicals business. And yet they had Dulux paint, they had Quest's fragrances, they had texture division. So they kind of had, you know, companies that were engaged in four of the five main senses. And I was sort of brought in to summarize all the stuff that was out there around the senses and well-being over half a year. And that kind of started the interest, really. And then this Sense Hacking book was kind of a chance to revisit some of the same themes and bring in some new ones and to see, you know, which of the ideas and insights have stood the test of time, which new approaches to hacking the senses have been developed, and really to put the science in the context of the individual and sort of their daily life, from, you know, the home, the kitchen, how to sleep better, to perform better at the gym, to work more productively in dating and in shopping, even in hospital, in fact, all the different kind of scenarios or situations of daily life that we might encounter, and put the science in that context. And yeah, so we sort of nice to see both how, you know, some areas have really developed over the last decade or two, and how much more evidence there is today than there was back then. One of the big themes of the book is really, I think, around kind of the power of the nature effect, how topically framed as, you know, being exposed to or looking at nature can have, you know, beneficial effects on our social, cognitive, emotional well-being. And that was just really starting out 20 years ago. And now that's a really big theme. There's more and more evidence emerging about just how beneficial nature can be for us. And especially, you know, what kinds of nature work best? Is it the sight of nature, the sound of nature, the smell of nature? If you stimulate all the senses, does that work better to help reduce stress and so on? And what kind of, is it sort of planted formal gardens or is it wilderness? Should there be a bit of blue in there, of water? And that's all really come along. So that's been sort of gratifying to see that there's sort of more science on which to build and recommendations to sort of simple sense hacks that any of us could do, really, but which most of us don't do. And that's either because we don't realize how much influence the senses have on us, or because I think another thing that comes out of the book is that we're pretty bad at knowing how much better we'll feel if we do something like, it's probably no surprise to anybody that going out for a walk in nature, as long as it's not raining, makes you feel a bit better. But why don't we do it more of the time? Well, because none of us realize how much better we have, like, problems with effective forecasting. And it's that reason, that inability to predict how much better we'll feel if we did this or did that, that kind of, I think, stops many of us from taking the steps that could so easily enhance our quality of life.
Yeah, and it's it's that thing, like you said, that a lot of people don't really know how, I suppose, the senses can play into a lot of things in your daily lives. And there's a lot of stuff listed on the book description as well, which, when reading it, is quite surprising. Just one of the examples is how expensive face cream, how the smell of it can actually temporarily just remove wrinkles. And that was a big shock to me just to see that, because I'm suddenly thinking, how on earth does that work?
So this kind of goes back in a way to my work over the years with Unilevers and companies like that on deodorants and sort of body, home and personal care, sort of beauty products. And that, I think there's a lot of psychology of the senses in there. And everything from the packaging to the fragrance you add, and how quite often the effects that we think or are told that products may have may not be occurring through the roots one might imagine. So you pay all that money for the face cream and you imagine there must be some, you know, chemical with an unpronounceable name there in the ingredients list that's doing the stuff to regenerate your skin and take away the old covering. And yet it turns out that what we smell has a big impact on our mood, on our relaxation, stress, or an arousal. Whether we recognize we're smelling something or not, and quite often we just don't realize the smells that are around us. But in the case of the cream, if you add a relaxing fragrance to a face cream, then what happens is when people rub that face cream on, they get the fragrance right near the nostrils. And that relaxing fragrance then does what it says. It will help to relax people. They may feel less stressed, they may be less sweaty, the heart rate may go down. But also, if you're less stressed, then your face will sort of relax, and that can help to eliminate some of the wrinkles. So it's absolutely true what they say in the fact that this skin cream, you know, can help remove wrinkles over and above any possible effect that the ingredients may have on skin texture. There is this kind of cross-sensory, cross-modal effect of what you're smelling that's doing part of the work. And the more you look, and wherever you look, it turns out that while our experience of the world is kind of seeing things and of hearing things and of smelling things and of tasting things and then of feeling things, our brain all the time is kind of combining the senses, so that simply by changing, you know, what you smell, you can change what you feel. We've done a lot of work on that with, you know, fabric conditioners. But if I change what you feel, then that can change what you hear. And if I change what you hear, it changes what you see. And the senses are kind of talking to each other all the time, often below the radar. We don't realize that's happening. Our brains just kind of tell us about the results of the combination of the senses. And quite often, you know, sometimes our brains are wonderful, but they can't process all the information that's coming in through all of our senses at once. So we tend to be selective, and hence we tend to ignore or not be aware of stuff in the background that doesn't change much. So I just give this sort of example from the start of the book, thinking about, you know, the smell of your own home. A smell that probably most of us have been increasingly exposed to during the lockdowns, when we can't leave our homes. And yet it's a smell that most of us don't realize is there, because it's kind of constant. It's in the background. When you go to somebody else's house, they always have a smell. Everybody else's house has a smell, but your house doesn't. But it does. And you sort of realize it when you come back from a long holiday and you open the door for the first time and there's a strange smell. And that is the smell of your own home, but then it's gone. And that smell that's in the background all the time can still be affecting us, even though we ourselves can no longer consciously perceive it. And hence that's part of the power of the senses too, that things below the radar are having their subtle and not so subtle effects on us,
And does any of this change these unconscious decisions and this processing of the brain change when you're actually made aware of things like that? So now that I'm made aware of the fact that, say, expensive skincare, the fact it's to do with all the smell and stuff, would that change the actual outcome?
So I think in some cases possibly, but probably in the majority of cases not. And that can be because either, you know, it's hard to, you know, some of these sensory cues are sort of operating below our conscious radar. So if you're not aware that they're there, it's hard to kind of do anything about them because there's nothing to respond to. And, you know, a lot of the things that we work on, you know, when we, for example, we take a bunch of, you know, 300 winemakers, wine writers, wine experts, and give them some wine, some white wine, and some rosé wine, and some white wine, coloured rosé, pink. And if we tell people, you know, ignore the colour, we're just trying to distract you, people are unable to ignore the colour, even though they know it's there to kind of trick them. Another example is where you have this what's called a McGurk video, where you see somebody's face, and if you look at one face, it sounds like they're saying one word, but if you look at a different face, the same sound sounds like a different word. And even kind of illusion for 20 years, I know exactly what's going on. I can point to where in the brain it's happening, but my brain gives me the illusion just the same as somebody who only sees that thing for the first time. So the fact that our brain kind of combines the senses automatically and before we're aware can means that a lot of the time these interactions just happen, and knowing about them doesn't provide any way to avoid them happening. So, you know, some of the other sort of more cognitive effects, so if you look at, again, in sort of the beauty, home and personal care kind of domain, then if one looks at the weight of things that are heavier seem better. And if you take uniform size products like lipstick or wine, then there's kind of a pretty strong correlation between the amount you pay for a lipstick or a bottle of wine and the amount of glass you get. And in the wine case, and it's eight grams of glass for every extra pound sterling you pay across the full range of wine prices. And the correlation's even stronger for lipsticks. So you're able to interpret some of these signals and know what's happening. But I still tell, you know, one of my friends, given I've worked so much on wine, they say when they come around to dinner, you know, what wine should we bring? I don't know what. I just say, you know, put it in a heavy bottle, and I'll be happy. Tell me it's expensive, put it in a heavy bottle, and it'll be great. In that case, I know what's going on. I know how it works, and yet it still works.
Mm. And what is some advice people can take from this podcast, I guess, to help improve their own lives and hack their own senses?
There are recommendations for each and every sense. And while we are kind of visually dominant creatures, we might think, you know, recommendations about what color to paint your kitchen or breakfast room so you don't eat too much, or which room to paint color to paint your bedroom so you sleep better. There are guidelines in the book for all of those things and more. And yet, it's probably, you know, sort of smell and sound are much easier sensory cues to change. And hence, for that reason, I think they're the ones probably where the sort of some of the simplest sense hacks can emerge. And that can be everything around, you know, using relaxing. Because, I mean, the majority of people complain about not getting enough sleep, and one of the chapters in the book is all about the importance of sleep. That's one of the revelations for me, was just how important sleep is, because I used to be somebody who didn't sleep much and was sort of, you know, sort of proud of the fact, like Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan, I could do 4 or 5, well, 6 hours a night and still work productively. But after reading around the literature, you realise, no, we all need our sleep. And you know, something like 13 of the 15 leading causes of death and illness are all made worse by a shortage of sleep. No way around it. And hence there, you know, things that you can do to help improve sleep, sense hack sleep. And that can be something as simple as, you know, using a lavender scent, say. That and some of the research shown to be even more effective in improving the right kinds of sleep than taking sleeping pills, which knock you out, but don't give you the right kind of sleep to help recover. I think, you know, given that so many of us are finding ourselves at home, then zoomed out was the expression, you know, from too many meetings, work meetings at home, and that can be quite stressful sometimes and exhausting. And so one of the tips there is to say, you know, if you just come off a sort of stressful work call with your boss or your company, then one of the simplest sense hacks is simply just to change the smell of the room you're in. Doesn't matter what the smell was before, but just change it to something different. Why so? Because our brains kind of associate emotional stress with fragrances in the way that when you go to the dentist, say, and you get that smell of cloves, eugenol, suddenly you get stressed. That smell isn't stressful per se, because we've associated it with stressful and tooth pulling and drilling and things like that. Then, you know, simply by changing the smell, that can provide an effective kind of mental reset for us as well. And then through, you know, the sort of importance of sound and music, and that can be for different reasons. Music to help us work better, music to help us, you know, slow down or speed up our eating and drinking. And that's kind of one of those elements that are kind of easy to change in our home. Whereas if you paint your kitchen baker miller pink, kind of bubblegum pink, because it says in the book that might help you to eat less, well, once you've done that, it's going to be quite an expense to change it back again if you don't like it. Whereas, you know, adding or changing the scent or thinking more carefully about the kind of auditory backdrop is much easier to introduce and to change. And that really, you know, what we should, I think we should all be doing more of is trying to engage better with nature. And that can be through going for a walk. It can be through exercising in nature, because then you're more likely to stick to your regime if you do that. But it can also be as simple as, you know, bringing nature into the home, and be it through something as simple as one of those kind of screen savers on your computer. That's a beautiful nature scene when you turn on your machine. Staring at that can improve your well-being. Listening to the sounds of nature, to even plastic plants seem to enhance our well-being. So I think there's something really interesting there about both the nature effect and engaging it through all of your senses, but also then, you know, how we can sort of digitally simulate or reproduce nature and convey some of the same benefits that will, and there's going to be a mounting body of evidence now, help us to relax, improve our mental, our physical, our social and emotional well-being.
Mm. And I don't have data to back this up, but just from I suppose talking with friends, family, and just personally seeing what other people are sharing online, it does seem that it, at the current situation in the UK, it's a lot harder for people to stay positive, more so at the minute. Do you think it's more important than ever that people do understand their senses more and really take control to improve their lives?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So in writing the final stages of the book, was sort of, in a way, ironically helped by lockdown, because I had to, couldn't leave the home, couldn't go to a conference or anything, I had to stay and get things done that I've been putting off for a while. But, you know, I was sort of writing the final bits of sense hacking as the COVID pandemic was unfolding. And then it's sort of hard to know, is that a good or a bad coincidence, and how much of the COVID situation to incorporate. But I think it's certainly the case that people report being a lot more stressed, but a lot more uncertain. And it's in those situations when we are more stressed and worried that things like ambient scent have a beneficial effect on us. I think even before the pandemic, urbanites, which is the majority of the world's population, were spending 90 to 95% of their lives indoors. And it probably doesn't feel like to any of us like that's true, but you know, survey after survey shows that to be the case. So what lockdown has done hasn't really necessarily made us spend any more time indoors, because we couldn't spend much more than 95% anyway, but it's kind of made our environments more monotonous. It's sort of the home, which can mean that we're less aware of how those sensory cues that we're so familiar with, like the smell of our own home, might be affecting us. And it can also make it difficult for us, you know, to sort of separate out the work from home life, and hence people, you know, can't get to sleep because they're sort of working from the bedroom, or there's not that clear differentiation between different aspects of our lives. So I think there, clearly, you know, especially now when the lockdown started, we were sort of studying this a bit, and as each period of lockdown in the UK has unfolded, people's behaviours changed. It's not the same each time. We do different things, we're drawn to different things, we're worried about different things. And there, you know, for the first lockdown, well, it was kind of surprisingly sunny and beautiful weather in March and April last year. So that's a very different kind of thing than it is, you know, at the moment, where it's sort of freezing cold and dark in the middle of winter, and where we kind of know that in northern climates, you know, many people suffer from kind of seasonal affective disorder, resulting from an inability to get enough natural daylight. And that's going to be exacerbated by these, you know, instructions not to leave the home. So that's again something to worry about and think about how we can hack our environments or change our behavior so as to make up for the kind of sensory imbalance that these lockdowns and the pandemic has induced. And the one that's really sort of striking to me has been the kind of just seeing how many people, because I think one of the part of the sensory imbalance in society is around touch hunger, not getting enough tactile stimulation. And that's something that's been really accelerated by the kind of lockdown. And how many examples have you seen on TV and on the news, you know, the sort of care home residents saying, all I want is just to hug my family. You can see them through the glass, maybe if you're lucky. You can speak to them. The one thing that's missing is touch. And that's been, you know, sort of brought out as such a fundamentally important, that kind of hugging and tactile communication. And that's the one that's really been, you know, strikingly lost. And hence, you know, thinking about ways how to bring back some of that, and how to make the kind of the tactile contact we get the best it can be is there in the book, and it's clearly been more important than ever, I think.
Yeah. And I find the book, a lot of the ideas it talks about is very fascinating, and I really think that if people listening to this enjoyed the interview and what you've spoken to, that they should really grab a copy of your book. Where is the best place people can get the book from?
I suppose probably on the Amazon or some such these days. I'm not sure if we're allowed to get it. If bookstores are probably all closed, aren't they? So it's probably only online. But I think there's an audio version and Kindle version, no doubt, and a good old fashioned physical copy that has a nice, interesting tactile texture on the outside.
I hope you enjoyed listening to today's episode with Charles Spence. This podcast is now available on YouTube and all major podcast platforms. If you would like to follow us on social media, then all the links can be found on the 99% Lifestyle website. At the end of each interview I conduct, I ask interviewees to give me 5 recommendations for our audience. This can be from books you should read, musicians you haven't heard of before, other podcasts to listen to documentaries you must watch. These recommendations are sent out as a free newsletter each and every week to the 99% Lifestyle newsletter subscribers. All issues are archived on the website too. And if you would like to read Charles Spencer's recommendations, then simply head over to the 99% Lifestyle website and sign up using the contact form. We'll be sending his issue out very soon in the future. If you're listening to this podcast episode after it has been released, then there's a good chance then his issue may have already gone out. By signing up to the newsletter, then you will also be updated about new podcast episodes, blog posts, and various other product releases we do, from clothing products to new art prints. Thank you again for listening to today's episode. We'll be back very soon with episode 10.